Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Andrew Burstein, the Charles P. Manship Professor of History Emeritus at Louisiana State University. His new book is Longing for Connection, Entangled Memories and Emotional Loss in Early America. Andrew Burstein is the Charles P. Manship Professor of History Emeritus at Louisiana State University. He's the author of many books, including Jefferson's Secrets, Death and Desire at Monticello, and The Passions of Andrew Jackson. He's also the co-author of Madison and Jefferson and The Problem of Democracy, The President's Adams Confront the Cult of Personality. Today we're talking about his new book, Longing for Connection, Entangled Memories and Emotional Loss in Early America. Andy Burstein, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, it's good to be talking to you again, Sue.
It's as if our fascination with the Founding Fathers never goes out of style, and in this book you show them in a new light. It's more of an emotional history rather than a biography. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the importance of emotional history, why we need to have that context.
It's something I've thought about for a long time, and the subgenre of history called emotional history was first fashioned in the 1980s, but I think because professional historians tend to specialize in just one subgenre in history, whether it's political history or military history, economic history, social history, emotional history doesn't spring to mind, at least in history departments. But the fact is that, can you think of any kind of history that's not an emotional history?
Yeah.
I can't. So of the books that I've written in the past, this came about probably as a result of a book that I published in 2013 called Lincoln Dreamt He Died. And I had the misfortune of my editor and publicist for that book leaving the company the very week before the book came out. So it's not a bestseller. But I think I invested more of my love of research in this book than any other book, because in Lincoln Dreamt He Died, I've taken the American dream most literally. And I went back into the archives, libraries across the country. I mean, this was my summer vacation year after year. And by looking at old letters and diaries from the 1760s until Freud showed up in America in the early 20th century, I saw generation by generation how people recorded the dreams. They never published them. They were never part of an autobiography and that sort of thing. So you really have to, you know, dig into the archive to find people writing about their dreams. And there's a good reason for that. Doctors, medical theories of the late 18th, early 19th century, did not treat dreams as autobiographical texts. They treated dreams as a function of indigestion or incipient madness, that when you had a dream, a weird, weird dream, it wasn't just your emotions living on their own, as neuroscience tells us. You know, the reasoning or judgment in the brain is cut off, and it's just a portrait of our emotions. And gives us insight into who we are, and it helps us, you know, in an evolutionary sense, it helps us combat the kinds of issues that we may face during the daylight hours. So it has more than one function. Anyway, I discovered that gradually, decade by decade, people started sharing their dreams with friends, with loved ones, interpreting them. And there's this whole way of getting inside the life of the mind of people who lived a couple hundred years ago. And so whenever I pose this question as a cultural historian or an emotional historian, were they like us? One of the ways to figure that out is to draw the boundaries of their consciousness, their sense of the world. How did they deal with the primitive nature of medicine? The fact that they had a lot of children, that the average woman, mother gave birth to or was pregnant half a dozen times or more.
Right.
So, and you know, you find these large, very large families. So when half of your children are not going to survive the childhood diseases, they'll die before they're 4 years old, 50% of them, and women dying as a result of postpartum difficulties, right? There were so many men and women who were married multiple times without getting divorced, and it was because they lost their partner. Mm-hmm. And so how do you deal with, and this is one of the chapters, deals with, as you know, the shipwreck theme. And when people go on long journeys in the 18th or early 19th century, let's say you leave New York Harbor and sail to London. And if the winds are going in the right direction, it may just take you 3 weeks, but it could take 2 months.
You have this wonderful image of letters crossing each other in the Atlantic on two different boats that just stopped me in my tracks.
So it could be 4 months before you find out whether your husband, your child made it to London. So how they're dealing with the fears that they naturally have when someone goes on a long journey, and especially because the medical environment is such that there's no way of curing diseases. They do have laudanum and opiate, which takes pain away. But that's basically the only, and then they will try leeching or bleeding the patient, which of course is nonsense. They had very few options. So I'm looking at the boundaries of consciousness, the boundaries of emotion within which people lived in the past. So the bottom line here is, number one, emotions have a history. Number two, an emotional history of the United States from 1776 to the Civil War is what I like to call history from the inside out, that it's expressions of the heart, the life of the mind, reading habits, friendship and commiseration, and, because I know you're going to get there, and maybe this is a segue, the importance of poetry in their lives, something that we don't recognize anymore because we have so many other ways of connecting with immediacy, that the typographical culture of back then meant that people commune by reading poems to one another. And those poems also expressed feelings that a poet could express better than an ordinary person, because American English or British American English didn't have the range of emotion baked into it that it's, subsequently had as we become more open and less repressed as a culture.
Well, I guess that's what you call aspirational language. You know, you find someone to speak for you in a way. The thing that's so lovely is that it's such a common context. People were, they seem to me to be so well-read, but that could just be hopefulness on my part. But,
Well, you're right, but to be completely candid, there are a lot of good histories that look into the lives of unlettered people. So this is obviously a book about people who were learned.
Yes.
I would say most of them are what we call middle class, but they all had a love of reading and had private libraries. So some of them are famous and a lot of them are not known at all, but they were definitely, among, I wouldn't say elite, but among the educated class in America.
And they were prolific writers. They wrote journals, letters, commonplace books, in addition to, the important documents of democracy, for example. I mean, I'm curious, do you keep a commonplace book?
Yeah, I did for a while. I don't do it anymore, But occasionally I will go back and try to get some inspiration if I'm working on an article or a book and I'm thinking, oh, didn't I commonplace, when I was reading, oh, I'll give you a good example because I did this recently. Paul Ricoeur, who was a French philosopher of the 20th century, he lived into the 21st. And I just wrote this down because I thought, in talking about memory, in talking about historical memory, I wanted some quote to look at that would remind me of what went into this emotional history. And here's a quote from Paul Ricoeur that comes out of my now defunct, but still, personally valuable commonplace book. And it goes like this: memory does not only bear on time, it also requires time, a time of mourning. And to me, this says that virtually every backward glance has some emotion attached to it, mm-hmm. whether it's a lost object or a person who you once loved and you don't know what happened to them, because this was a childhood sweetheart and you lost touch. Those kinds of things. What we call nostalgia. I'm fascinated by memory because it's what historians do, obviously.
Sure.
But also, just for any of us, everybody will recognize this. We can't, if someone says, what did you have for breakfast yesterday? Or what did you have for dinner the night before last? There's a very good chance that we won't remember. But there are very vivid memories that come back to us, and we don't know what part of the brain this is stored in. Or what's the difference between the brain and the mind? I don't think science has anything close to a reliable definition of that. Uh-huh. So we're mysteries, We're perplexing, wonderful beings. And we think that our memories are reliable, but we know that we're basically forgetting machines. And so how do we make connections, right? Mm-hmm. Emotional connections, especially. And the fact is that, and this is another thing that goes into the book that I know that, you gleaned from it, is that we know that culture evolves, generation by generation. We differentiate ourselves by saying, a generation ago, our parents' generation, it was this or that no longer makes sense to us. I just notice with my students at LSU that I would refer to something of emotional importance, let's say 9/11, and they have no emotional memory of it. How do you convey, let alone when I was a kid, the lunar landing mm-hmm. in 1969? How do you convey the emotional power of something to someone who grew up just knowing, 50 years ago, people landed on the moon? But with me, I see vividly what I saw in black and white on the television when my parents let me stay up late, uh-huh. Past midnight to see that small step for man. So who we are as feeling people, as nostalgic beings, as people who are constantly probing our individual memories and trying to share what matters most to us. Well, this is where poetry and today it's more visual media. When you want to make a connection, you'll say, did you see the movie such and such, mm-hmm. Or a TV show? Remember that episode when this happened? We have our cultural icons and our cultural vocabulary. So what I tried to do in this book was to understand the cultural vocabulary of a people for whom emotion was expressed by quoting Shakespeare, quoting Alexander Pope, quoting poets that are long since out of print. But for them, these poets or poems helped them express love, fear of mortality, and they had religious, they had religion too. But the poets, whether they were religious or secular, or Shakespeare, there's a chapter on Shakespeare because they're only 100 years away from Shakespeare's right. lifetime.
But you also teased out the beauty of phrases that captured our hearts, like the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, and we define happiness, largely in terms that are culturally specific to our generation. The time of the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness was closer to what we would describe as a moral community, a community, kind of a spirit that permeated a larger number of people, that you felt a sense of belonging. So it was less of an individual framework,
right,
that we're talking about with happiness, and more of a community framework, because the Declaration was meant to express the mind of the patriot community.
Which is why I think you devote so much time and space to the founding of Thanksgiving.
Right. Well, one of the people I settled on, that is a mechanism through which the stories are told, Sarah Josepha Hale, who was once, everyone knew who she was, her magazine was the best-selling magazine in America, and the fact that it was edited by a woman, and that she was responsible for so much of the culture. Well, all I have to do is say, Mary Had a Little Lamb. That little ditty was Sarah Josepha Hale. She kind of knew everybody, and everybody knew her, and all kinds of notables wrote for her magazine. And while it was largely read by women, Godey's Ladies Book, there were as many male as female contributors to it. And it was Sarah Josepha Hale who began promoting the idea of a national holiday of Thanksgiving in, I think it was the 1840s. And she wrote to the presidents one after the other. And finally, it was Abraham Lincoln in 1862 who responded and said, this is a great idea. And this is not in the book, but he was also trying to help the fledgling, oh, that's a play on words there, turkey industry. So, to have the Thanksgiving dinner, it was conceived of by, again, this pursuit of happiness, this moral community by Sarah Josepha Hale as a quasi-religious annual event, a way of taking pride in family and connections, social connections, and just, you know, appreciating our humanity. And she was a deeply religious woman. And she approached Lincoln, and Lincoln thought it was a good idea to make it a national holiday because it was a way of bridging the differences between the North and the South, that even though we're at war, we recognize that we're one people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the community that he was trying to restore, even, you know, during this horrible war. So Sarah Josepha Hale is one of the people I examine, but it's actually a chapter that is about trying to understand how, you know, in terms of the emotions that permeated American society, how do we explain to our satisfaction how religious people, good people, white people, Northerners, subscribed to the American Colonization Society all the way up to the Civil War. Lincoln was one. James Madison was president of, during his retirement in the 1830s before he died, president of the American Colonization Society. Its purpose was to repatriate not just emancipated slaves, but free blacks, you know, people of color born in the United States but who were not citizens, could not vote, repatriate them. Ship them back to West Africa because that's where they would be happy. They would be restored to the life with political rights that they deserve, that they didn't deserve to be second class in America. And so the idea that this would be not just good for African Americans, without even asking whether they thought it was a good idea, it was like this kind of patronizing ideology that somehow grabbed the attention, not just of the Southern slave owners who thought, well, this would be a good way to get compensation for emancipating my slaves because, you know, I'd be paid for it. And then we would be whitening America by sending them, you know, on boats out of the country. And it was not only impractical, but it's just a terribly ugly thought. that without consulting Black people to say, we know what's best for you, and it's to be back in Africa where you people belong. And so how could some of our most impressive minds, not just, you know, religious people, but political leaders, kind of band together and say, and until the anti-slavery societies began to flourish as we get closer and closer to the Civil War,
right,
the American Colonization Society that Sarah Josepha Hale was promoting constantly, she wrote a book called Liberia, mm-hmm, and it glamorizes the return of African-Americans to West Africa on, you know, the say-so of white America. Again, it's such a hard thing to wrap our minds around, but that's the provocative purpose of this book, is to ask not just the questions that are fun, like what Shakespeare did they quote,
yeah,
or what was their sense of humor like, but the hard questions, like the normalization of this kind of racist ideology across America. It was, for a time, a very popular way of thinking in white America. And I try to explain it as best I can by seeing through their eyes and not judging them, because that's too easy, but trying to understand, again, the boundaries within which they lived and who could escape the bonds or bondage of culture, right? Who could be so progressive that they had a 21st century mindset in, mm-hmm, 1840? It's hard not to judge them, but I think good history requires that we get out of our comfort zone. 50 years from now, historians and just journalists and ordinary folks are going to look back on us, and we're going to look pretty evil. I mean, not just because as consumer, you know, fossil fuel, just like our collective refusal, why didn't individuals do more to save the planet when they could have?
It's the same thing with the racial blind spot. Until we understand it, we never will get past it. But I'm curious now, in this age where we are and the pace of change, do you think a book like this would even be possible 200 years from now? How would that come about?
I'm a historian. I don't prognosticate.
Well, you got to wonder. You've got to wonder a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. I'll put this in terms that the founders would have understood, at least, which is that they believed that the answer to how do you preserve a republic? Expanding education. So right now, we know that, first of all, teachers are not valued in our society the way they ought to be. And as a culture, we still behave in our educational system the way we have for a long time, kind of with blinders on, as you put it, in that we don't pay close attention to other cultures and other languages. If you were born in a European country, you would learn English. We expect everyone to know English. It's a language of business. It's a language of everything. You know, my European friends know 2-3 languages conversantly. You know, we don't start in kindergarten. I mean, we isolate ourselves in our educational format. And I think that if the United States of America is to have a prosperous future, it probably, as the founders would have said, starts with improving access to education and being of the world and not apart, mm-hmm, from the world, and not existing in our phones or in social media, but to think more expansively. That's a big question in my mind about what's happening to our culture in the 21st century, is that we are kind of retreating inward or expecting from technology answers that are just sort of like junk food, the nutritional value that our brains need.
Well, when you talk about the brain's longing for connection, you know, it's hundreds of years later, here comes E.M. Forster with Only Connect. And it's as true a need as it ever was, really. And you show that in this book, which is immensely moving and beautifully written. So thank you.
I'm so glad you liked it. Yeah.
We've been talking with Andrew Burstein, whose new book is Longing for Connection, Entangled Memories, and Emotional Loss in Early America. Andy, thank you so much.
I enjoyed speaking with you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Don't forget to check out the authors coming to town for the Essence Festival of Culture. There are 3 full days of literary programming, July 5th through 7th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Montreal Convention Center. Featuring authors as diverse as Roxane Gay, Ayanna Mathis, Nell Irvin Painter, Philip Williams, and many more. Check out essence.com for complete information. The William Faulkner William Wisdom Creative Writing Competition has extended its deadline to June 30th for all 9 categories. Novel, nonfiction book, novella, short story, novel in progress, essay, poetry collection, individual poem, and short story by a high school student. For complete information, visit FaulknerSociety.org. Winners will be announced at the Society's Fall Festival, September 26th through 29th. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.